rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you very much. Be seated, please. We appreciate the opportunity to be here in the 3rd Judicial District today in Canyon County and sitting as the Idaho Supreme Court for our first hearing of the day on Friday, May 12, 2023. This case is entitled Montirth versus Dorsers, but apparently the appellant, Mr. Dorsers, has passed away, and we just received notice of substitution of party pursuant to IAR 7. It was filed with the court May 10th, substituting Dina M. Dorsers Thompson as personal representative of the estate of Hendrik Johannes Dorsers. So it's for the record, we have appellants Dorsers and Justice Prevails LLC represented by Wyatt Johnson. And we have Ray and Susan Montirth by Gary Edson. Mr. Edson, do you have any objection to this substitution of parties? You have 14 days under our rule to respond, which would mean it goes to the 24th of May.
I did not, Your Honor.
All right. The record will show you do not have an objection to the substitution, and it will be ordered, so we may proceed with that. Gentlemen, either of you have any preliminary matters for us today before your arguments?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Johnson, you may proceed, sir.
Yet another relic from the 2008 real estate bust. I still have 3 or 4 of these on my desk. This involves a very old mortgage. It's a 1-year mortgage, $650,000, granted in 2006, matured in 2007. Was not foreclosed within 5 years of 2007. 2 payments were made on the mortgage in 2019. Under Idaho law, those payments revive the mortgage, and it's able to be foreclosed. I appreciate Judge Whitney's analysis, but I think that he got it entirely wrong when he granted summary judgment saying that this could not be foreclosed. This case gives us an opportunity to dust out or explore some of the dusty corners of Idaho law. And I think the consequential points to be looked at in this case and the points that will carry on beyond this case have to do with a couple of points. First one is the scope of Idaho Code 5238. That's the statute that says that payment will extend the debt. We have an opportunity to clarify the law of gift, specifically when you've got mutual exclusivity of a payment on contract versus when you've got something that's a gift. Third, there is the issue about this quashing of the list pendants that the trial court did. I do not think that is permissible, and I think it's inappropriate. Fourth, really, and honestly, I hope that we're not getting here. It's an opportunity to clarify this distinction or this conflict that we have in the law right now regarding quieting title to old mortgages. We have a conflict between statute, Idaho Code 6-411, and a later case, trustee v. Wren. I want to start with the payment after the statute of limitations. Judge Whitney's ruling was that in order for a payment to extend the debt under the statute, it needs to be made before the expiration of the statute of limitation. That's not what it says in the statute. That's never been held. There's never been a ruling to that effect. And I think it's in fact wrong.
And it's a question of law?
It is a question of law. The In 1910, the statute only provided that a new writing would extend the debt. It did not have that provision dealing with payment. And in the Dern v. Olson case that was addressed at the time, Dern addressed that statute. Dern addressed a writing that the issue happened to be a writing that was done before the expiration of the statute of limitations. But it did examine the language of the statute, which talked about a new or continuing obligation. And Dern recognized at that time that the statute was designed to apply both before and after the expiration of the statute of limitations. A writing that was done before the expiration of the statute of limitations was a continuing obligation. A writing that was done afterwards was a new obligation. And that's, Dern recognized that that was the effect of the statute, that it was not constrained by the statute of limitations at that time. When, in 1923, the legislature amended the statute to say any payment will substitute for a writing, it did nothing to change the time frame of that statute. So as that statute was designed, it was designed to specifically to address payments, whether they are before or after the statute of limitations. There has been nothing to address that since. The case law that has recited, made recitations that a payment made before the expiration of the statute of limitations is nothing other than dicta. The Collection Bureau case, I think, was the first one that said that. The Collection Bureau case was not addressing a post-statute of limitations issue. They weren't deciding it. It was just, they were saying that Dern dealt with the same situation that we did. The follow-up case, the Dracos case, again, was not dealing with a payment or a new writing. The Dracos case was simply addressing a waiver that existed in the original note. So it's a question that's never been directly attacked, but I think under the law as it exists is that payment, whether before or after, satisfies the statute. And I think that's how the statute operates. So that was the first basis.
Before we go further, yes. Let me just ask a general policy question.
Sure.
Assuming your statement of the law is correct, how does that comport with the general policy about the free alienability of land? We have these mortgages out there, for lack of a better word, like these zombie mortgages, which can be brought back to life suddenly after having been dormant for years. I'm just wondering, from a policy perspective, how wide and diverse this is.
Well, I mean, good policy, bad policy. I think initially that's a legislative question. We're dealing with the statute. So is it a good idea? Probably not. Is it the law? I think it is. And it's also, unfortunately, it's also consistent with, I believe, what the state of our law is on acceleration and mortgages, where you have a breach early in the mortgage, but the statute of limitation doesn't run until the maturity date. So you can have somebody who defaults on a mortgage in year one, then the statute of limitations won't start running until year 30. I personally don't like it, but I think that's our law. So. The next level of decision that the Judge Winton came through, and I think this is still erroneous as a matter of law, is he came to the conclusion that there was no payment to extend the debt. And he does this in a complicated way.
Johnson, you said that's a question of law. Why do you think that's a determination of the law as opposed to fact?
I think it's because the way that he got there, he made conclusions that misapplied the law. He essentially gave himself bad jury instructions, ruled according to the bad jury instructions, made conclusions based on erroneous statements of law. Therefore, the findings are erroneous. Let me explain. First, the issue that there was no payment. He gets there in a couple of ways. The first way that he says that is he goes, well, this was a dissolved entity. It couldn't have made any payment. It just makes no sense. This was something that Judge Whitney brought up on his own, sua sponte. And it's entirely wrong. Dissolved entities, these Washington dissolved entities, continue for winding up on their business. So that was just an erroneous legal conclusion.
So under Washington law, does reaffirming a debt fall under the definition of winding up?
It's, I don't know if that's the case in Washington law. However, we're dealing with an Idaho mortgage. So I don't know that Washington law would apply on an Idaho mortgage. I think the Washington law applies on the legality of the Washington entity. But I think the Idaho law deals with the issue of an Idaho mortgage and its enforceability.
Right, but I'm talking about in terms of what a dissolved Washington entity can do, it's winding up, and so we would look to Washington law to say, does reaffirming a debt fall under the umbrella of winding up, wouldn't we?
I admit I haven't parsed that specific question to see if there's a distinction, but from my recollection of my research of Washington law, there weren't any constraints other than to wind up the business. I would have to look at that. I don't know. I can't think of a reason why there would be a reason to parse that, because this is an existing debt of the entity. It's a way of winding it up. So I just don't know the answer.
Before we leave Washington law, what is the authority, the actual statute, by which the gentleman who made the payment was deemed the statutory agent? I did a little bit of mucking around in the Washington statutes. I couldn't find it easily, and I couldn't find it anywhere in the briefing where there's any discussion of the actual statute that deems him the statutory agent.
I tried to get this. It was how that worked is the evidence in the record goes through, and you had cascading entities. You had the Bear Lane, the debtor entity. That was wholly owned by Union Land Company.
But I'm just talking about what's the statute. Am I interpreting it correctly when it says statutory agent that we're talking about the Washington LLC statute?
Yeah, he was the manager and owner of the company. It was a member managed company. He was the member manager of Barclays North. Barclays North was a member manager of Union Land. Union Land was a member manager of Bear Lake.
Right, but I just want the statute. If you don't know, just tell me.
If I have it, it's in the brief. I don't have it cited, but it's going to be the portion of the Washington statute that says limited liability company is member or manager managed.
Respondent hasn't objected to that designation on appeal or below, did they?
No, as a matter of fact, they are claiming their title based on the claim that Mr. McCourt was the statutory agent. Now, neither of the parties disagreed with this. This was something that Judge Whitman came up with. And so, in fact, I mean, the Montiers, they obtained a quitclaim deed from Mr. McCourt as a statutory agent for Bear Lane. They understood him to be a statutory agent as well. So, it's just, and the testimony is that Mr. McCourt explained that he was the manager, he was the one operating the companies, there was nobody else. I don't know what other evidence there could be to establish it, because there's not, especially in light of, and you know, you've got the dissolved entities about filing statements with the Secretary of State or anything. It's just winding up. When you have these dissolved entities, you've got to wrap up their business somehow.
And so jumping to another point, on the issue of who made a payment, Mr. McCourt didn't make a payment, Bear Lane didn't make a payment, the Land Pro Group, Inc.
Right.
made a payment. And I don't see anything in the record to indicate how Land Pro Group, Inc. was related to Bear Lane, any evidence that Land Pro Group as a corporation was authorized to make a payment on behalf of Bear Lane. So
That's my struggle with the argument that a payment was made to extend or revive the debt.
See, that gets into the provision of the UCC that's cited in the brief. Is the authority is the land pro was an account that Mr. Court controlled.
Well, it's more than an account. It's a corporation.
Mm-hmm. True.
So it's, I mean, are you alleging Mr. McCourt was treating Lampro Group as his alter ego?
This is what Mr. McCourt effectively did. And he tested, you know, this is based on his testimony that these payments were intended on the Spare Lake debt. That he specified that's exactly what the payments were for. How do you get there effectively, substantively? It is that when he directs that, because Quality, instead of writing, essentially what he did was wrote a check or did a wire, whatever, from LandPro over. The alternative would have been LandPro distributes the money to Mr. McCourt, Mr. McCourt contributes the money to Bear Lane, and Bear Lane makes the payment.
And where's the evidence? Because all I saw, I read Mr. McCourt's deposition, all he said is, I own it, the corporation.
Right.
But that's not how corporations work. Corporation made the payment. So where is the evidence that the corporation passed some kind of resolution, that there was some corporate officer who was authorized to make this payment, the corporation was intending the payment to be made on this debt? I mean, that it's all good and well that Mr. McCourt thinks this, but the payment was made from a corporation, not from Mr. McCourt.
Oh, Mr. McCourt is the owner of the corporation, as far as we know, the evidence. His decision on what the corporation did, or his statement about what the corporation did, is what the corporation did.
But that's my problem. There's no evidence of that. I don't know what his authority is vis-a-vis this corporation.
So I'm confused. Is Bear Lane an LLC, a limited liability company, or is it a corporation?
Bear Lane's an LLC. I would argue that there is then at least a question of fact, because I think what you're saying is there may need to be further evidence on that, but we do have the owner of the corporation who is explaining that this payment was made at his direction and authority. He's certainly got the apparent authority to make that payment. There's no evidence to the contrary that indicates that he isn't. And I think that the issue would be is if we were to explore further to see if there was some sort of limitation on his authority, I think that would be additional evidence that might create a question of fact. But I think that it certainly isn't. I don't think it's fatal where the owner of the corporation explains that that's what he did. And he certainly has the apparent authority. And I don't see where there's any indication that he wouldn't have that authority.
And my struggle is, when it comes to corporations, we don't typically have owners. You know, we have incorporators, we have shareholders, we have directors, we have officers. I can't tell from his deposition what bucket he falls into. So if he's just an incorporator or he's just a shareholder, I don't know that he has the authority to direct the corporation to make a payment. If he's a director, then my question is he the only director, or are there other directors? Or is he an officer, and the board of directors or the bylaws or the articles of incorporation, something gives him authority to make these decisions, to direct these payments? But there's a link that's missing when he testifies, I'm the owner. I don't know what that means. It could mean any one of a number of things, and that for me, it doesn't automatically say he has authority to direct the spending of corporate funds.
Well, it's the evidence that I've got in the record, and I'd have to maintain that I think that it's still based on that. That is enough, especially in light of any no evidence to the contrary, that I think that is evidence that you got an authorized payment. It's evidence of it. You might want stronger evidence. You might feel more comfortable with that, but I think that does give evidence of the authority to make the payment. because it was the owner.
You would agree that if we grant a remand, if you prevail on this, that that's an issue of fact that would have to be determined at trial?
We could go and I think if there's a question about it, I think it's a question that would have to be determined at trial. Right now, there's no evidence to the contrary. I think, we could certainly, going back, it's certainly something that I think that could be fleshed out quite easily.
For summary judgment purposes, was there any evidence introduced that suggests that Mr. McCord is not the owner and did not have authority for land broker?
Zero. Zero. Right. The only evidence is that he was the owner. It was okay. So that's what we have. And perhaps it would be better to have it more fleshed out, but that's what I have. It's my record. So with that payment, I think that the payment is made and the court's designation that it is for debt cuts off any question about this being some sort of a possible gift. There's a Stanger case that I cited. Stanger stands for this proposition, I believe, because the court in that case overruled a finding by the trial court that a transfer of a farm was a gift. What had happened was there was a situation where family farm transfer, there was a contract for deed, but then the family came back later and said, well, no, we really transferred it as a gift. They were trying to decide if it was community property. Court, without a lot of discussion, just came down and said, no. If it's a contractual transaction, it's just not a gift. Period. I provided a whole authority that goes further and explains that, look, the two concepts are mutually exclusive. The trial court didn't really address that head on. I think the trial court was proceeding under the concept that there was no payment by the debtor at all, but then seemed to throw in this discussion that this was a gift. Provided that there is a payment here on the debt, I think that as a matter of law, that cuts off any question that this could be a gift. These things always go faster than you think.
Before you run out of time, could you get to the issue concerning the trustee case and status of quiet title versus mortgage?
Yeah, the trustee case is, to a certain extent, one way or the other, I think we all just appreciate the decision on it. I don't want this to come out of this case for obvious reasons, but this trustee case is a wart out there. It has been out there. You've got the statute that was enacted in 1951 that says you can quiet title to a mortgage that's expired, which would seem great. You have the trustee case, which was entered a year later, which says you cannot quiet title to an expired mortgage if the debt's still outstanding. From my experience, the law that's been applied has been the trustee case and not the statute, but the statute would seem to say the contrary.
I got the impression that 6411 wasn't even considered in the trustee case.
I couldn't tell. And I looked at that case, and I looked to see if that was what it was, and you can't tell from the case, which is the problem. And courts are still following the trustee case. And they're citing to it. It would be nice to just have this one cleared up, quite honestly. But I'd really rather not that it happen on this case. I'll sit down and say the rest for a moment.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Stretson?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. First of all, I appreciate your the entire court coming to Canyon County. My client is a resident in Canyon County and certainly made it more convenient for him. The facts in this case are, as you've all indicated, undisputed. There's no question that what happened in 2006 when the two mortgages that we're disputing were issued, that the Dorsey's note was recorded in April ahead of my client's Centrum Financial's mortgage. But we are dealing with a mortgage and not a deed of trust. So some of the cases that we've been talking about in our briefing, I think I want to point first off to the statutes that are relevant specifically to mortgages. The one that Justice has picked up on and I've been relying on at the local court is 6411. 6411 says exactly what it says. It says that you can foreclose. 6413 also says not only can you foreclose an instrument that is stale, but that you don't have to prove that the underlying debt, you have to show that it was paid. It resolves trustee, and I would premise that trustee is not this boogeyman that we're alleging it is. I think trustee was a unique situation where there was much discussion early in the opinion about the fact that the assignee buying at a sale was aware of and had connection to this earlier mortgage, was aware that it was out there and that it wasn't paid, and they were trying to jump in, if you will. So I don't think trustee is this onerous hurdle we have to overcome. I certainly wish there were more case law describing what the limits of 6411, 6412, 6413 are, because those directly address the issue we have in front of us.
Is the tender rule still accepted in Idaho?
Is what?
The tender rule that was announced in trustee or applied in trustee?
I don't think under the statute it does, in my opinion. I think that the statute directly addresses the question about the what the requirements are that a person trying to quiet title or foreclose their lien and dealing with, as you yourself, Your Honor, mentioned, these zombie mortgages or liens or judgments that are outdated, unenforceable. There must be a way to quiet title to eliminate those as clouds on title. The legislature addressed that, and that's what those three statutes deal with.
But doesn't trustee seem to say the contrary to 6411?
I agree. I think, well, as I said, I think it does. I think there is that conflict. The trustee says one thing, the statute says another. But as I mentioned a second ago, I think that there's a distinction in trustee. I think that the court looked at what the circumstance, the unique circumstance of the party buying, and talked a lot about equity, that this is an equitable court. The court should basically not allow a windfall. And that's not what we have here. We have from 2019, from 2006, and we've got in excess of 12 years gone by. All of our cases that talk about this issue of statute of limitations say the overriding premise is we're not supposed to allow these old stale things where you don't have the parties anymore. Good example, we're sitting here this morning talking about substituting parties. Because who's left to address these things?
But Mr. Johnson is suggesting that the subsequent payments in 2019 have resurrected the mortgage. And that's really the question, isn't it?
That's absolutely the question. If you look at 5238 and you look at the cases talking about what's 5238 require, Brower is the opinion in my from this court that addresses what do you have to do. If you want to rely on this idea of resurrection, of reinitiating the statute of limitations, and Brower says you have to have not just a payment, there has to be the debtor himself has to do an activity, do something that acknowledges unequivocally all these things that are enumerated in Brower.
But I've read Mr. McCourt's deposition, and it certainly suggests that he intended it to be a payment on the mortgage.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I'll tell you why. If you read what Mr. McCourt said, in his deposition. He says, and the question was from Mr. Johnson, and why did you make these payments to Mr. Dorsus? I've known Harry for a long time. He's very ill, he's sick, he's destitute. I got some funds in from an empathetic and a moral perspective. I chose to make those payments. I paid for by a corporation that is not the debtor.
But keep reading.
I agree. Then he goes on and says, yeah, well, I intended to go to that. But what you're looking at then is conflicting, and that will take me to my next point, Your Honor. What we have then is undisputed facts. We have an inference that can be drawn from those undisputed facts. Then in the statute, summary judgment, the court sitting as the trier of fact has the ability to draw the inference most reasonable under the circumstances. Judge Whitney was the one who heard all of the argument, read saying that apparently you've gone above and beyond, and I appreciate that, having read the full deposition. But the question then becomes, what capacity, as Judge Zahn noted, what capacity was that made under? And so on the one hand, I argued for the rule that has to apply because the judgment was then, he was sued by Mr. Dorsus. Does the single action rule apply? And they say, oh, no, that wasn't the case. But they're arguing here now in front of you that he's the statutory trustee.
Well, let's take a step back then. You said earlier that the trustee, that the debtor has to do more than just to make a payment. What more do we expect of a debtor than to make a payment? What more can we reasonably expect?
I think Brower addresses that. I think the Brower case specifically says that there has to be some acknowledgement of the underlying debt, either as to its continuing viability or the willingness to pay it. That's exactly what this court said in Brower.
But Brower was a different situation, wasn't it? The question in Brower was, how many years of damages to these crops did you agree to settle for? Did you agree to pay me for 1 year, or did you agree to pay me for 3 or 4 years? And everybody agreed 1986 had been paid for. The question was whether the agreement extended to subsequent years. So that's different than this situation, isn't it? Where everybody knows what the debt is, everybody knows what's owed, nobody's quibbling with the amount or which debt you paid toward.
I agree. There was a mortgage. There had been a lawsuit over the mortgage. A judgment had been rendered in favor of Dorsus on that issue. The debt had been scheduled in a bankruptcy and discharged. So the fact that a payment, are we saying then that there is no standard? Because that's the logical conclusion. We look at 528 and you say, well, any amount of money coming from anybody at any time, regardless if it's 30 years down the road, which is what essentially was argued at the law court in summary judgment, that there is no limit.
Well, and that's not what I'm addressing. I'm addressing your argument that you have to have a payment plus something in writing.
If I gave that impression, I apologize. That wasn't my intent. I'm not saying that there has to be a writing. I'm saying there has to, from the circumstances, and that's the language, the circumstances surrounding the payment have to show or infer that what was happening was the debtor was acknowledging the debt in some fashion.
So to Justice Brody's question, when Mr. McCourt testifies, I intended it to be on this debt, and I own this corporation, is that enough to create a genuine issue of material fact?
I don't believe when the court sits as the trier of fact. I think there is a dispute. It's not a dispute about what the facts are. It's the inference drawn from those facts. And I think that under
But those facts have to be uncontradicted.
I'm sorry?
Those facts have to be uncontradicted for the judge to draw the most logical inference.
And I agree with you, Your Honor. I don't believe that anyone's contradicting. I mean, there's no one else.
McCourt says, to follow up on Justice Brody's question, other than the debt that is shown on the promissory note, Exhibit 1, Did you have any reason or obligation to make those payments to Mr. Dorsers? No. And you're suggesting that's not a, the facts are uncontroverted on that statement?
I'm taking issue, Your Honor, with the assumption that what the motivation or what the payment was about wasn't the first quote, which is, I know the guy for many years. He's sick. He's destitute. I came into some money. He doesn't say Lampro came into some money. I decided to do it. He says, yeah, that was the only thing I had. But I think there you can draw an inference either way. And I'm suggesting that under the summary judgment standard, that once we got to the point of having undisputed facts, we had carried our burden of proof, then the burden shifted to the party raising the defense of this reinstatement. And the conflicting inference, and it's an inference because you're right, there is no dispute about what the facts are.
Is there any evidence in the record suggesting there was some kind of collusion of any kind? I mean, typically, a relationship between a debtor and a creditor, you know, they take care of these things, and third parties are affected by them. And if there's an intent to harm a third party, certainly in bankruptcy law and other law, we look at these kind of preferences and things. Is there any evidence that that was going on here? Excuse me.
The parties that existed, Mr. Dorsus, we were informed, we tried to take his deposition, we were informed he was in Germany or in an undisclosed location. We could never gain access to him. So to answer that question, it was impossible to get those answers.
Right. But so the answer is there is no evidence.
There is no evidence, I agree.
So what is the inference that the district court drew regarding this debt?
I think the inference that was drawn was that it was an obligation that was stale, that it was an obligation that otherwise had been discharged as a result of the bankruptcy, that the intent behind it was personally motivated, that there was no under questioning at the end of that series of questions. They're asking about winding up. He acknowledged he hadn't done anything after his discharge from bankruptcy, hadn't done anything in regard to Bear Lane, and that these facts are the undisputed fact record that Judge Whitney looked at.
Inferences or are those findings? It seems like there's a fine line between the two, but they sound more like they could be findings and not just mere inferences.
I agree. I think they were findings of fact. Those were the findings he came to, having reviewed the record and reviewed the arguments on the summary judgment standard.
So on summary judgment, I know inferences when you don't have a jury are proper, but are findings proper?
I'm sorry?
Are findings proper on summary judgment, regardless of whether a jury's been asked to decide the case or not?
I don't know that findings are proper. I think that when you take what was presented in evidence as a whole, it didn't rise, in Judge Whitney's opinion, to show that there was this, that there was a standard met to comply with 238.
Typically, though, on summary judgment, the only findings the judge would make is the findings as to which facts are disputed and which facts aren't disputed. Is that incorrect?
No, I think you're right.
And this one was disputed, was it not?
I don't think the fact was undisputed. I think we never got to what the payment actually was made. I mean, that even was unavailable.
I'm confused. It's the first I've heard of this. The payment wasn't actually made?
What was presented in response to discovery on the issue of this payment was one page of a statement that was...
It was an electronic transfer of some kind.
Yes.
And so are you disputing whether the transfer actually took place?
At the moment, I did, yes.
So would that be a genuine issue of material fact that would need to be resolved by
the jury? I think for the purpose of summary judgment, we conceded that a payment could have or would have been made. The questions were, what was the intent? Who made them?
So you're not challenging that today?
I am not.
You would challenge that? You would challenge that?
I did below, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Before I run out of time, I did want to address some of the other issues, but I think those major points about what is the standard for getting over 5214A, clearly we're way outside 5 years, and do our statutes that deal with foreclosures have any impact on this case where 6413 says that you can foreclose and quiet title to a stale mortgage and eliminate it without having to prove that there was not, that the debt hasn't been paid in full. That, I think, is what the law says. When I look at Draco's, this court's much more recent opinion, I think Draco's addresses those issues. And does speak to that argument about trying to have an offset or reinstatement that was not accepted on the case there. The point I want to swing back to on this issue of what was the status Patrick McCord, the argument they're making here is that, well, Patrick McCord, even though these entities have been dissolved and out of existence since 2009, was a statutory trustee, and he directed these payments, and it's his intent, and trying to elevate him to this position. Yet, in defense of the single action rule, they're saying, oh, no, he was sued in his individual capacity. But at exactly the same time in 2009, he executed a deed to move foreclosure. He was sued in his individual name because the entity had been dissolved. If he was statutory trustee in 2019, he certainly was still the statutory trustee in 2009. And he was sued, and a judgment was recovered. The point I want to make in regard to those undisputed facts is that there was an election of remedies. Dorsey's elected to sue McCord. And if he was the statutory trustee, he was a statutory trustee in 2009, he recovered judgment, the judgment was discharged in bankruptcy, and the election of remedy was made, and the mortgage then had no further force or effect. I think that's an important distinction to make, that you can't claim he was the one directing the payments in 2019 if you're not also willing to accept that in 2009, he was the statutory trustee who got sued. And that Dorsey's directed that activity. He elected to pursue both the deed of foreclosure and to sue and recover a judgment for $1.4 million. So in that regard, I think regardless of how you perceive the argument about the payment, you have to put the same hat on him in both time frames.
Why should we judge his actions the same way from 2009, when in 2019 apparently he's dealing with an ill, old, destitute man who's now passed away? Why do we have to say he has to respond in the same way in both situations?
Because it is the debtor and the creditor. It's Dorsey's and Bear Lane. The assertion in 2019 is that McCord, acting as statutory trustee, and the winding up and speaking specifically to what happened in the 2009 timeframe, he says, Barclay's ship had sunk. We were going to avoid more litigation. We issued deeds of lieu of foreclosure. We consented to judgment. All that certainly speaks to winding up. And then he gets sued in that capacity, because the entity's gone now. He gets sued by Dorsey's. Dorsey's made that election. So I think that is why, Your Honor, that the the relationship to the debtor has to consistently be the same. If we're going to say that he took money from a corporation that had nothing to do with Bear Lane, that is in the record, that he directed how or who or why payment was to be made, and disregard his testimony that says, because I knew him, I had empathy for him. And so I think that Judge Whitney did what is appropriate under summary judgment, and that is to draw the inference that's most reasonable. And I think that is what led to the ruling.
But that seems like a finding of fact.
I'm sorry?
That seems like a finding of fact, not an inference, saying that, oh, I'm going to disregard your statement, you know, that you made the payment on this debt, and I'm instead going to give more weight to your statement that you were trying to help this man out. I mean, that was contested, wasn't it? What his intent was? Was it to help a friend, or was it to make a payment on the debt, or was it both?
Then for argument's sake, Your Honor, I would say this, that if there was a fault in his reasoning on the payment, there was enough evidence that was undisputed that doesn't require a drawing of an inference, and that is on the issue of the single action rule.
He could have been
wrong on the payment piece, but still been right on the single action rule that there had been an election of remedies, and he speaks in the order, he speaks to both.
And the district court, though, declined, I read his order as declining to rule on the single action rule. When I read his verbal announcement of what he's doing, I read him to say, I don't need to go here because I can resolve it otherwise.
I think that the opinion that he came to, the conclusion he drew on summary judgment, was supported by the evidence that was given, not disputed facts, and that there's an error on, but still came to the ultimate conclusion that was correct. And I think that's the standard that ought to be applied in Judge Whitney's case here. If I could just touch on...
Before you move topics.
Yes.
What is the statute that gives McCourt the title of statutory trustee? What's the citation?
It's Washington Revised Statute. I believe it's in Mr. Johnson's brief. I don't know it off the top of my head.
Okay, I'll look again. I didn't see it, but it's possible I just overlooked it.
Yeah, I thought you referenced it. It may have been on the summary judgment argument, but I believe he had it in this. Maybe there were other statutes he cited, but I believe I reviewed it once in his argument.
Do you dispute the conclusion that McCourt was the statutory trustee?
I would say no, if we're applying the same standard across the board, that he occupied that position throughout his activity interfacing with the Dorsey's debt. The other issue I wanted to address is the issue of Liz Pendens. Liz Pendens' statute, basically, there is also in the foreclosure statute 6407 specifically says that if a party is prejudiced, that if the party is not prejudiced by the transfer of title through foreclosure or foreclosure sale, the remedy was, we argued that they should have pursued a stay of proceedings under Appellate Rule 13, and they chose not to do that. They asked for recording of Liz Pendens. Liz Pendens had been filed at the beginning of the litigation. It appeared as if the only purpose was to try to quash the sale or to taint the sale. The judgment of foreclosure was entered. An order of sale occurred. A foreclosure sale did take place redemption period expired, the issue under applicable law, I believe, makes it moot. They've had their opportunity. They elected not to pursue a remedy that would have protected their rights. And I think the statute, even if Judge Whitney were wrong in saying, well, you couldn't have recorded the list pendants, it made no difference. And that is the standard in applying, arguing for appeal on an error, is did it affect a substantial right? And I would argue it did not. Sale took place, their rights, they still had the right to appeal, they argued the appeal, there hasn't been a transfer to a third party. So I think under this statute, again, looking at the specific rules that address mortgage foreclosures, there is a remedy that they could pursue, and I think there's no substantive right of theirs that was prejudiced. So on the list pendens issue, I think it's not an issue that should prejudice the panel in its review of Judge Whitney's opinion.
What is the standard of review we apply to the decision to strike the list pendens?
I think the standard's pretty clear that when it's an issue for summary judgment, you apply the same standard that the reviewing court.
Are we applying the summary judgment standard to the decision to strike the list pending?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think in that regard, you're looking to see if there was clear error. Were there facts in the record to support Judge Whitney's opinion?
So it's not an abuse of discretion standard. It's a clear error standard?
Correct. Yes. I think I'll rest on my brief, return the remaining time to, unless there are other questions.
Appears there are none. So thank you very much, Mr. Hudson.
Thank you.
Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
7 minutes, Your Honor.
Let me jump to this issue of the judgment against Mr. McCourt real quickly. This argument is a little bit of a sleight of hand. Idaho law makes a clear distinction for purposes of the one action rule between actions on debts and debtors and actions against the guarantors. The paperwork that's in the record shows that if the action against the court, if anything, was in his personal guarantee, and it would have been as a guarantor.
And when you refer to the evidence in the record, are you talking about his deposition?
There was before the court on summary judgment the pleadings. I believe it was the complaint and the judgment on Mr. McCourt's. So it showed that. It was a personal action against Mr. McCourt. It was not an action against the entity. And so if anything, it would have been an action against a guarantor. Actions against guarantors do not trigger one action rule. There's not been an election of remedies. Those have historically been treated separately. So that is there. I think as far as the list pendants, I think that that's just an error of law. I think that the decree quashing it, I think it's a nullity. And I think it arises from a misunderstanding from what a list pendants is. A list pendants is nothing more than record notice to the world that this proceeding is happening with respect to the case, that there is a question about the title that's being addressed. It does not attach. It's not like a lien. It's not like a mechanics lien where something needs to be filed to perfect it. There's no legal effect to a list pendants other than to avoid third parties from becoming bona fide purchasers. And
so Mr. Edson suggests that the sale of the property has mooted the list pendants question. I'd like to hear your response to that.
I think that does not moot it because the matter is still proceeding. The list pendants is still a record, and
The judge struck it.
The judge struck it, but he didn't go and remove it from real property records. And I think that the remedy that I'm seeking, I think the appropriate remedy, is ruling of this court that order was a nullity. Because all that the list pending is supposed to do is to be out there and give notice to the public that this proceeding is pending. And when the proceeding is over, the public has noticed that this proceeding is over. It's for the benefit of protecting the public, or third parties.
And so how does that affect the substantial right of your clients?
It affects the substantial right of my clients because my client is at risk of a bona fide purchaser coming in and taking this property away.
And has that happened?
Has not happened yet, but it does not mean that it won't. If this court upholds that and that was pending is stricken, the Monteers turn around, I guess they bought this, they weren't bona fide purchasers. They turn around and they sell this to somebody else and they don't disclose this proceeding, then you probably have a bona fide purchaser. That is strictly a function of the Recording Act. And I think that this issue about treating these as some sort of means or something is, I think it's fundamentally wrong. I think it misunderstands the whole purpose of the expense.
How often does a sale end up going forward with the list pendants recorded?
Depends on what the, I think it depends on what the issue is. In which case, I don't know how. The pendants do put people on notice. However, if there is a dispute, shouldn't the buyer know about that? And the list pendants is addressing a substantial right. And more importantly, if the result is that we are correct, why should a party be able to circumvent the results of this court by selling the property out of the proceeding?
And my struggle is the stay rule and the requirement to post a supersedis bond also serve as some protection for the person who prevailed below. And so I understand the argument that you're making an end run around the stay statute and the requirement to post a supersedis bond, because the reality is in many situations, seeing a list pendens of record, the buyer's going to say, I'm not touching it.
It's a Recording Act function, and I appreciate that, but this is actually a perfect example of exactly why, and the Suits case addressed this, and the Suits case said that this is entirely appropriate. This is an example of exactly why it's appropriate. The Dorsey's mortgage is senior in time. There is no scenario in which Dorsey's would owe a red cent to the junior position mortgage holder. None. If Dorsey's were constrained to follow the stay proceeding and post a bond to pay somebody that never got any indebtedness to, I think that would be an abuse. And it also deals with, I think it's appropriate for issues where you are dealing with title, because the title is, it just is. And you put this in any other circumstance. If you get into a quiet title case, just straight quiet title between two competing landowners.
I'm just curious, if the list pendants was so important, and I understand how you articulated it, why did you wait until after the decision was made in this? Why didn't you file that when the litigation was initiated?
Because we had a mortgage on record. We didn't need to.
So the list pendants was intended to replace the mortgage in the public record?
Well, it's the mortgages of record, they were going in their head. You were going to go ahead and have a foreclosure sale, and we have a dispute because the order said that this forecloses out. He foreclosed or quieted title to mortgage, and we're like, no, that's, and if that goes in record, we're saying, no, the proceeding isn't done, we're still claiming that title.
I'm just wondering, if someone purchases a property at a mortgage sale, aren't they constructively on notice that there could have been a potential dispute about that mortgage?
Could be. That gets into the inquiry notice, which we've explored. We've explored it before with Nampa Highway District case. And I understand that issue of inquiry notice is out there. I'd certainly rather not gamble on whether or not that amounts to inquiry notice.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, we appreciate your argument. This matter is under advisement, and we will render a decision. We'll be in recess approximately 10 minutes.